Good morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Tuesday, September 8th, we are studying Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 to 22. In today's text, the Pharisees and the Herodians attempt to trap Jesus with a question about paying taxes to Caesar. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us Pastor Philip Hoppe. Pastor Hoppe serves at Trinity Lutheran Church in Colby, Kansas. Pastor Hoppe, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Glad to be with you again.
As we get started today, Pastor, remind us of the context here in Matthew chapter 22.
Yeah, so we're kind of continuing in this whole section here where the opposition to Jesus is sort of growing, and I guess Jesus is, maybe we can say, is engaging with that opposition pretty directly. He's doing that both through some of the actions he takes, but also through the parables that he's teaching. And then, as we'll see today, in responding to the Pharisees and others that sort of come alongside of them, responding to their questions. But we kind of have this growing opposition to Jesus, in particular because he is becoming more clear, I guess I would say, or at least more regular in his criticism of the religious leaders, of the temple system, of, we just, right before our text, we hear this parable of, those who were supposed to be called to go to the feast, but don't want to go. And, both probably there talking about the religious leaders and maybe more broadly about, the children of Abraham in general by blood. So, there's just more and more of this kind of contention, and we see Jesus not backing down from it in one sense, and the Pharisees kind of ramping up their attacks, and they're trying to come up with some way to discredit or displace or whatever Jesus, whatever they end up needing to do.
Looking at the shape of Holy Week thus far, back in chapter 21, kind of right after Palm Sunday, you have the chief priests and the elders who come up and question Jesus' authority, and he immediately puts them back on the defensive and again speaks, as you said, directly engaging the conflict. He's not withdrawing at all. When he would withdraw previously in the gospel, it wasn't because he was scared, but rather he was building for moments just like this leading up to Good Friday. But we've seen Jesus now on, kind of three parables right in a row speaking against these religious leaders. They know he's talking about them. We heard that at the end of chapter 21, but they have been unrepentant. And so now I think as we start with this section and then the next couple of texts, we're going to see that they continue in their unrepentance. And now they try to, Jesus has landed his punch. Now they're going to try and land a punch against him. And time again, we're going to see that just doesn't work. If you try to attack the Lord, you're going to lose.
Yeah, right. Prepare to be humbled, right? If you want to come in pride, you'll be humbled. And certainly that's what we see here with the Pharisees. They think they're pretty crafty, pretty tricky, and yet Jesus always has an answer or a not answer or somewhere in between, but always that right. Confounds them ultimately.
All right, let's go ahead and take a look at this text. Again, we're in Matthew chapter 22 today, beginning at verse 15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his words. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us, then, what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. That is our text for today, Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 to 22. So, Pastor Hoppe, we mentioned the context already. Jesus' enemies have heard the parables spoken directly to them. Now they come, and Matthew tells us they are plotting how to entangle him in his words. The primary group is the Pharisees, but then they find an ally with some Herodians. Talk to us about these two groups.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously we kind of probably have a better sense, or at least think we do, right, of the Pharisees. I think it is always one thing we want to keep in mind is that, you know, when we really look at what we know about these groups, we need to be a little bit cautious, not fill out their entire sort of way of thinking, their worldview on everything. But, and especially as Christians, we want to especially just focus on the things that the actual scriptures teach us about those, because we know for certain those things are true. And that's where when we get to the Herodians, it's a little bit harder to figure out who they are, because the scriptures don't tell us much except, right, that they seem to have some connection to Herod or the Herods, right, that Rome had sent to rule. And so at least it seems on the basic idea here that they're going to ask this question about, which really the heart of this is, are we going to submit to the Romans or are we going to rebel against the Romans, right? And this tribute tax seems to be kind of the, you know, that's the object lesson that's going to be used to drive at this point. And at least as best as I can tell, right, they bring these two seemingly obviously would kind of think about things differently, because the Herodians seem to be much more, you know, positive towards the Romans. And the Pharisees at least tend to at least want to keep the Romans out of their business and hope for a day, right, when they're put out of business for good, right? And so they come and ask this question, it seems to me at least, with this idea that if he answers one way, he's going to upset the Pharisees. And if he answers the other way, he's going to upset the Herodians. And so this is part of their plan. And, you know, like you said, when you're reading this in context, you understand the opposition, the tension that's going on. But even if you just come into this pericope or this reading, you know, by itself, as we often do, probably for worse than rather for better. But when you do that, even just right from the beginning, you get this opposition, right? That they went and they plotted and they're going to try to catch him in his words. And they're bringing these, you know, usually not friends of theirs to try to trip him up as well. And then they sort of butter him up with a bunch of flattery and just everything about it, right? And of course, if we aren't sure how this is going, then we get into Jesus's mind, right, where we're told he knew exactly what they were doing. He knew they came at him with malice. And so both of these groups probably had a reason that they were not too fond of Jesus, and they kind of pair up here thinking that they've got the sure trap set with their presence, I think.
One thing that I find intriguing about the alliance of the Pharisees and the Herodians in this text, and I think it shows itself in other texts in the Holy Week narrative as well. I think Luke is the one that tells us that Pilate and Herod were not friends until they had that time, you know, where Jesus went back and forth between them in his trial. So there's a couple of times where people who are otherwise probably enemies of each other become allies of each other in some sense because they share an opposition to Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's always struck me as almost like it's a very tragic irony, I think, that you have on the one hand, God gathers together his church, people who otherwise, you know, might not share anything in common, end up sharing everything because they have Christ. And on the flip side, those who otherwise might not have anything in common and might otherwise be enemies become allies because they reject Christ, which I find a very terrible tragedy of Holy Week, but that still, I think, bears itself out in life today.
Yeah, it really gets into just this biblical idea of, right, the wicked and the righteous, kind of dividing the whole world into those two categories. And obviously, there's always a lot that needs to be said when we talk about that. But just in the most general sense, you're right. It's sort of everybody gets divided up on two teams. And the team that's opposed to Christ is, again, even if they normally can't get along for the sake of demeaning Christ, they will. And I think, you know, it wouldn't take too much to apply that to our world as well, where we see sometimes people coming together that might not have a lot in common with one another, but they kind of, the one thing they have in common is you know, probably in their own minds, I don't know if they would make it as personal as they're against Jesus, but they think, right, they're against Christian thought or Christian worldview. And all of a sudden, yeah, you see kind of groups coming together to, you know, to fight against, ultimately against Christ, whether they know it or not, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, some of the issues in our world today that deal with, say, matters, especially the fifth commandment and the sixth commandment of life and marriage, like you can see how really if everything else were equal, there would be groups that they disagree very, very vehemently on, say, maybe like the role of women or what right. is a woman, you know, that question. And yet, even though they disagree on that, when they find themselves fighting against Christianity, like that somehow unites them, even though there's very, very strong differences in what they actually believe. They find this common enemy in Christianity. And again, in a very tragic way, that unites them almost as like an anti, I don't know what else to call it, as an anti-church.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of, you know, you see that process then too of sort of when that happens, kind of the hardening of the heart, right, that occurs because it's almost like, you know, they meet up with someone else that has, again, a similar opposition, but maybe a different argument, right? Or a different reason for their argument. And soon, you know, they're kind of embracing that as well, even if that wasn't their initial thought.
Hmm. Yeah. So again, to see the Herodians and the Pharisees getting along with each other here is surprising. And yet, because they have this common enemy in the Lord, they do gang up on him, attempting to, as it says, entangle him in his words. So, and you mentioned this, they kind of butter him up. This is another feature, I think, of Holy Week, is that the enemies of Jesus say something that oftentimes is quite true of Jesus, and yet they don't mean it. They say it in an unbelief or in a way to entangle him. And I think that's the case with the words that are spoken here at the beginning of the text. Talk to us about the way they try to butter Jesus up here.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you said, if we were just to take this completely out of context, right, and say, hey, Jesus is one who is true and taught the way of God truthfully and didn't care what anyone else thought, right? We would all say amen to that. That is absolutely true. And yeah, it's one of those times where they're speaking something, again, not believing it themselves, but you know, they almost become teachers of the truth, right? Even though they don't intend to be. But you know, they seem to be kind of trying to get Jesus to just say exactly what he thinks. That's kind of how I feel like their flattery here is, go ahead, Jesus, just say it like it is. You don't have to worry about, we know you don't, so don't worry about what we'll think about it or what the Herodians will think about it. Just say exactly what you want to say. And again, they're just convinced that if he does that, they're going to have him.
Hmm. Now, you kind of, I think you've at least hinted at this, and it's in the background to be sure, the fact that the Pharisees and the Herodians don't really think the same on a lot of issues. What is the trap that's being laid? How does the presence of both of them, you know, maybe show us what their idea is in terms of trapping Jesus?
Right. So essentially, they're going to ask this question about whether it's lawful or necessary to pay this tax. And basically, the idea set up is that if Jesus responds and says, yes, pay this tax, well, then the Pharisees are going to say, you've got no religious spine, right? You're giving in to this oppressive, godless empire by just paying them with this, you know, this coin and just kind of doing that to make your life easier. And at the same time, if Jesus said, no, don't pay them, well, then the Herodians are going to say, what are you thinking, right? We have to cooperate with Rome at the very least. And again, this is where scholars, at least that I read, kind of disagree on maybe how aligned the Herodians were with Rome. But certainly at the very least, they could either argue that, you know, you shouldn't do this because we really like Rome, or at least you shouldn't do this because if people hear about it, it's, you know, Rome's going to come down on us. It seems like there was always kind of that idea, and maybe that was kind of a unifying idea even between these two groups, is that, you know, the best thing was to kind of continue to carry out life in a way that wouldn't capture the attention of the Romans.
Yeah, I mean, so one way or another, Jesus is going to be in trouble, they think, whichever answer he gives. If he says, no, don't pay your taxes, then he's in trouble with the Romans. You know, if he says, yes, or Yeah, if he says, yes, pay your taxes, then he's in trouble with the religious leaders, those the very pious Jews who would disagree with any sort of Roman rule. So it's, you know, pick your treason, Jesus. Do you want to say treason against God or treason against Caesar? That's the trap that they think they have laid. And I think, you know, when it comes to the Herodians, Pharisees, without knowing the specifics of them, if Jesus, you know, says yes to the taxes and, quote, picks the side of Rome, I think at least later in Holy Week, we see that members of the Sanhedrin apparently don't have too much of a trouble handing Jesus over to Romans to do the dirty work for them, such that even if, you know, even if the Herodians weren't as on board with paying taxes as it might seem, if Jesus, you know, says don't pay taxes, then they're probably not afraid to hand him over to the Roman authorities.
Correct. And when you put kind of like a little bit wider of a historical angle on this, you know, and again, this isn't, we get talk of Judas the Galilean in the scriptures, to be sure, and about him, you know, gathering people to himself. And then he kind of, you know, he gathers this group and then they're sort of scattered, right? And, you know, what we know of him a little bit historically is, you know, he, when this tax first came about, he was one who stood up and violently said, you know, we're going to fight rather than pay this tax. And so there's an additional pressure on Jesus, is that if he says no to paying the tax, not only is he just taking a stand on this issue, and not only might that upset the Romans, but he's sort of associating himself with probably, you know, this man that everybody at least remembered, who had particularly risen up and had been put down. At least, you know, if you trust the other historians, Judas's disciples and him were put on crosses and kind of scattered around town to make sure everyone got the message.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, this is a pretty solid trap, it seems, by way of human standards, until Jesus springs it. So before we talk about Jesus springing it, just the way that they butter him up again by saying, you are not swayed by appearances. You don't care about anyone's opinion. The other grand irony of that is that these men quite clearly do care about other people's opinions and are swayed by appearances. I mean, just the duplicity that's apparent as you've been reading along with Matthew's gospel, I think is very apparent, in that it's true that Jesus isn't that, but these people, they very much are.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And even, you know, getting down to, I was just studying some in the Gospel of Mark, and just this whole idea of, right, where they say, it's in Matthew also, I believe, right, where they say that Jesus taught with authority, not like the scribes, right? And you get this idea that, yeah, they cared about everybody's opinion so much that they had to cite the opinion of the other religious leaders. And then they were also very concerned about how their teaching was being received by the people. And then, you know, not swayed by appearances, right? This is probably one of God's chief charges against most people with authority, is that they end up, you know, showing prejudice against people or showing favoritism towards people. And that's, you know, again, they speak truth here that Jesus isn't doing that. But like you said, they kind of expose themselves here by saying that's what someone that is really a warrior of truth should do, is to be this way. And yet, like you said, they're revealed not to be those kind of people.
All right. So Jesus, again, springs the trap. Verse 18, but Jesus, aware of their malice, said, why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax. So not only does Jesus recognize their trap for what it is, but then he sets one of his own of sorts. Take us into this initial response of the Lord.
Yeah, I always think, you know, when we're told in the scriptures, right, that, you know, Solomon was the wisest man until Jesus, right? And this is very much like Solomon-type wisdom here, where he says, well, I can bring something up that's going to kind of reveal who the people involved are, right? And that's what he does here. So he tells them to bring out the coin that they would use to pay this tax, which was a denarius. And we get this denarius mentioned, you know, quite frequently in the scriptures, kind of, you know, referenced as sort of the day's wage for your kind of average laborer. But it seems that everything was kind of measured in it, right? To, you know, throughout the scriptures, oftentimes we're told this was, you know, this many denarius, or they had a debt of this many denarius. And so, and it's one of those things, you know, when you look in Bibles, you get certain Bibles that, you know, translations that want to try to translate all of these things into modern equivalents. And that's always a hard thing because it's shifting. But the denarius, I think, is kind of uniquely situated that when you hear a day's wage, right, we all can kind of go, all right, I mean, that might be different for different people, but I can at least get this idea of what it would mean to me to lose a day's wage, right? It, you know, to kind of think of it that way. And so he tells them, right, get out this coin. And, you know, they don't have any trouble. They pull one out right away, which is probably already part of Jesus's, if he, again, like you said, if he's entrapping them, they pull out this coin, right, which is a silver coin, probably about the size of a dime. And, you know, on one side, it has an image of the Emperor Tiberius. And on the other side, most people think at least that it is Tiberius's mother that is pictured. But so the first thing we have to get there is this is an image carved in silver, right? So already you have all the questions of, you know, the commandments saying don't make any carved images of any people. And here they are carrying these things around, right? And certainly the Pharisees, at least on the surface, would have, you know, told people don't have anything to do with idols, right? And rightly so. I mean, they should be teaching that. But so right away, he kind of says, you carry these idols with you everywhere you go, maybe right into the temple, right? With these temple or with these idols. So that's kind of the first thing. And then secondarily, there's what's said on the coins. And you know, through archaeology, we have a lot of these coins. In fact, you know, I know some people that, you know, own one of these things now just kind of to show what it was. But, you know, it, on the one side, it basically, you know, says his name, Tiberius Caesar. But then it says, son of the divine Augustus, right? His dad, Caesar Augustus. So he says, I'm the son of God, right? And my dad was God, or is God, maybe is probably the proper way to say that. That since he's gone, he's now been deified, or maybe was even before he died. But so you have that phrase that his dad is God, he's the son of God, which again should have been offensive to any Jew to carry. And then if you flip to the back, it says he's the high priest, right? So you kind of have both this idea that he is in the secular, or, you know, or I guess I'll use Lutheran terminology here, in both of the kingdoms, right? He's the top guy, right? The son of God says, I am the king. I am the emperor. Everything, right, goes through me and I have ultimate authority. And then also, right, he says, but I'm also being given rule over this area. I'm also the one that controls the religion of the area. And chiefly, right, he would be talking here about the Roman sort of worship and the gods they worshiped. But again here, to use a phrase like high priest, a Jew is not going to be able to hear that without going, wait a second, is he claiming he's sort of in charge of all religion? Which I think his answer would be, yeah, of course I am, right? This is my role.
So Jesus, in the context of all of this, Jesus calls them hypocrites. That's how they're putting him to the test, as hypocrites. Remind us what a hypocrite is, and then how their hypocrisy is evident. I guess maybe there's two things that come to my mind. One is the kind of what you're pointing out, that on the one hand, they want to test Jesus according to this coin, but they, at least in some way, have already shown themselves to be guilty of what this coin represents or the idolatry inherent in the coin. And then two, maybe the larger picture, their hypocrisy would seem to be that, you know, on the one hand, they're asking a question of Jesus, but they really don't seem to care about the real answer. They're just trying to put him to the test and they don't actually believe in him in any way.
Yeah, correct. So, I mean, the idea of a hypocrite kind of seems to go back to the idea of, you know, what we would call an actor, right? Someone who is playing a role but doesn't believe it, right? So you can play anyone and not believe in what that actual person would have said. So, you know, Jesus kind of points this out that they're sort of, right, they're playing that they are the shepherds of Israel, that they are the guys that are watching over the true religion of the triune God or of Yahweh, I guess maybe is how they would have phrased it at this point, right? And he says, but that's not who you are, right? And his parables have been revealing this, that that's not who they are. And then, you know, he takes that. And again, the question is, do they even really care about the tax, right? Do they even really have a care of it, whether he says yes or no, or is the only thing that they're going to get him to be entrapped in his words? And so again, Jesus turns this on them. He says, you're a hypocrite because while, you know, he might say other places, right? While preaching against idols, you carry an idol in your pocket, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, while talking about truth, you're trying to deceive me in this very moment. So that's the hypocrisy, is that they're not really there to guard religion. They're there probably in the broadest sense to guard themselves and their own power and authority. And so, yeah, he starts off just by kind of showing this hypocrisy with the object. Then he's going to go on to kind of teach more from that object what the greater kind of hypocrisy is about, how they're, what they at least say that they're concerned with.
Mm, yeah, and I appreciate you mentioning the matter of authority yet again. Going back into chapter 21, that question that the religious leaders had brought before Jesus about, you know, what right, what authority did he have to do those things? That does still seem to be in view even here, that they do not trust the, you know, believe in any way, shape, or form Jesus has any authority. Jesus will show that he does have authority. As the text continues, we'll pick up more on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Philip Hoppe this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org. LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Tuesday, September 8th. We're studying Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 to 22 with Pastor Philip Hoppe. He serves at Trinity Lutheran Church in Colby, Kansas. Pastor Hoppe, prior to the break, we looked at the test, the trap that is set by the Herodians and the Pharisees for Jesus concerning paying taxes to Caesar. Jesus has already recognized the test in the words of these hypocrites, and now he begins to test them himself. He's asked them to produce the coin for the tax. They bring the denarius, which you've already explained to us what it looks like, at least as best as we can do that on the radio without, you can Google this and find a picture of an image of a denarius if you want to get a picture of what Pastor Hoppe is talking about. Then Jesus is going to be very methodical in the way that he draws this out. He invites them to tell him, whose likeness and inscription is this? And they will answer, Caesar's. And Jesus then will say, therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Before we get to that, you know, ultimate answer of Jesus that's, I think, pretty famous, talk to us about this matter of the likeness and the image that Jesus particularly points out.
Right. So I think at this point, right, I mean, we have the whole context that we've already talked about, but here then he's going to center in and basically just say, whose picture is on this coin, right? And they, again, say right away, they know it's Caesar, right? And sometimes I think we often think this is sort of, you know, really odd that, you know, Caesar's picture is on here. Although then I go, look at our money, right? We put men on our money all the time as well, right? So probably not too odd. But in the sense of here that he says, you know, whose image in Greek here, right? Whose icon, right, is on this? And then he basically says, you know, kind of almost flippantly, I think here, just to make his point, he says, well, if it's got Caesar's image on it, and if he decided what would be written on it, give it back to him. It's his, right? And so they start there. And again, think how that already disarms his two enemies, because he's not really at this point making a theological argument. He's going to do that in a second. But right now he's just saying like, well, there's an easy common sense answer, isn't there? Mm-hmm. This is Caesar's money. Give it back to him. And in one way, then again, he doesn't really start with dealing with this question of should he really pay the tax or should he not? I mean, in one way, we could say he says yes, but not for the reasons that probably even the Herodians would have said, right? It's just, you know, why do you care about this coin? And again, maybe even with this bigger context of this is an idolatry or an idolatrous kind of object that you're holding anyway. So get rid of it for that reason, get rid of it because Caesar's marked it as his own. So just give it to him. Then of course, you know, I'll pause here for a second for your comments, but then, you know, but then we move on to that second part, which is even more important, right? About what Jesus really wanted to teach him, or at least what was at the heart of his teaching that day.
Yeah, and I think as we, well, let's work our way through the verse and maybe even through the whole text and then circle back to the, again, the proverbial statement. It's become a proverbial statement that Jesus makes. So we've got, you know, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's because, look, that's his image. That's his likeness. And then he says, to God the things that are God's. And I think the words of Jesus would invite us to consider, well, what bears the likeness, the image of God that we would then render to him?
Yeah, exactly. And that takes us right all the way back to the beginning to, you know, Genesis 1:26, where, you know, God sort of speaking to himself, if that's the proper way to say that, right, says, let us go and, right, make man, creating him in our likeness and image, right? So this, the point is, right, all of humanity, or right down to each human, is this icon, again, in the Greek, right, this image of God that is imprinted on each of us. And therefore, if you're going to say, well, if the image of Caesar is on that coin and you should give that back to him, Jesus says, well, if you are the image of God, you should give yourself back to him, in the sense of, you know, kind of think here of like, you know, the book of Romans talking about, right, offering up ourselves as living sacrifices, right? So it's the whole thing. So again, they're trying to ask, what about this one little particular tax that we're supposed to pay? And Jesus just comes back and says, whatever with that, right? I mean, I really do think he says, yes, pay it, right? And other scriptures say that. But then beyond that, the chief point he wants is your whole life, everything you are, bears the image of God. And so therefore, repay that to God. Again, not here in a sense to gain God's favor, right? But just a recognition that everything, your whole life has been given to you by God.
Yeah, and I think, so, you know, to the matter of the image and likeness, the connection to Genesis 1 with the creation of humanity, I think is a good one. Another verse that I've often used in connection with this is, I think it's Psalm 24, where it's the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. I mean, so ultimately, you know, the things that are God's go even beyond like what bears his image specifically within creation. But in fact, because he is the creator of all things, like all things, even more than just humanity, like all things are God's. And that's where like every aspect of my life, whatever touches this creation, is something that I should consider in light of the relationship to God, even more than my relationship to Caesar.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think, you know, some of this then comes back to this, you know, original question that they ask him, right, about, is it lawful? And in one sense, when they ask that question, right, Jesus could have answered, well, you know, the Roman law, yes, we have to pay the, right, it's, that's the law, is to pay the tribute tax. But once he broadens it out, as you say here, to maybe chiefly humanity, but then I think you're right, like more broadly, everything that exists, you know, then he's really asking us here to just consider again, everything about our life, everything we own, everything we see, and making sure that we're giving those things properly to God in response to his grace, his mercy, right, his love, that we offer those things back up. And when we look at that, then there does become kind of this question back to, are things that are legal always lawful, right? We can't just say because something's the law that it's necessarily we should do that thing, and that's giving God what is God's, right? And we have this in our world too, right? Where we would love for the laws of our land always to match up with God's laws. So again, we should advocate for that. We should advocate for it because we're Christians, because we believe the laws of the Lord are good for all people and things like that. But we also know that sometimes they're out of line with God's law. And again, the only way we can really make those judgments is to have that broadest sense of everything is God's. So it's not that this particular area of life governed by this law or that law doesn't have anything to do with God. Of course it does. Everything does. And how do we do the best job then of repaying those things to him according to the, you know, the abilities he's given us, the talents he's given us, the vocations he's given us, all those things.
So maybe let's take a step back for just a second to do a little bit of work on some of these terms. Because I think you've mentioned the like two kingdoms or the two reigns or realms of God. Some Lutheran pastors will talk about all those terms sometimes. So the two kingdoms, and even as it relates to this passage, you know, Jesus says, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Well, Caesar's dead. You've been talking about laws. So as we think about this today, like what are the two kingdoms? What's Caesar's? What's God? I kind of do some clarification so we can take this and, you know, use it in the 21st century.
Sure. So we get this basic idea, right, throughout the scriptures that the government, right, is established by God in every place and in every time. And therefore, right, that God's people, even if that ruler is not a God-fearing person, right, we are to honor them and respect them as one established by God. And part of that, right, we're told very specifically in other places of scripture is that we're supposed to pay the taxes they ask of us. Now, this doesn't always mean, you know, as Americans, especially, we're known for kind of disagreeing with our government and what they do. And I suppose that's not just an American thing. Nobody likes to be taxed, I guess. But we are told, right, that's one way we show them honor is by, in the end, you know, in America, we might have the right to kind of talk about where taxes should be or vote on what that can be. But in the end, once they're issued, we're to pay them, right? And why, again, is not just out of the threat of punishment from the government, though that could be involved too, but it, more broadly, because we do recognize that God is working through them. And in particular, he's working through them to reward those who do good and punish those who do evil. So that's where the, you know, there might be a sense of don't do this and you might be punished. That's a proper role for the government to play. But overall, it's just this idea that we recognize that God works through the government. We can, again, I think sometimes, particularly when we get frustrated with the government, want to kind of separate God from the government as far as we can, almost for his own protection, his own reputation, right? And yet you can't run very far in the scriptures without running upon another passage that says, for God's purposes, he establishes all authority. So that doesn't mean every person God puts there is God's guy in the sense of he would have voted for this guy, right? Or something like that. But it does mean he's established them for a purpose, sometimes perhaps to humble the people, sometimes to exalt them, sometimes to bless them, maybe even sometimes to curse them in one sense. But that's kind of this, you know, one side of the kingdom. And then the other side is what the church is doing in all times, right? And that's where we might think first and foremost of, right, give to God what's God's. We might want to go, well, yeah, that's just talking about what we do as the church and how we're to honor him there. But ultimately, we have this responsibility both to government and to the church and the, you know, the rulers in the church, right, is sometimes how the Bible speaks, the pastors of the church, that we're to honor them in particular ways as well. But, you know, you pointing out the broad nature of what is God's kind of helps us then to see that we can't have any part of our life, you know, we can't have our politics completely disconnected from a verse like this, right? We have to say, even, you know, to know what is government to do? What is it good for government to do? What's it bad? The only way we can know that is by understanding who establishes government and for what purpose.
Yeah, I think, you know, thinking about the way Jesus speaks here, that he, he does draw a line in the sense that he especially lets the people of his day know, and us still today, that Caesar is not God, despite what the coin says.
Right.
Caesar is not God. And so there is that distinction that you know, these two are not the same, Caesar and God. And yet, I think, and this is perhaps the more modern temptation, is to then completely disassociate our lives as citizens of a particular country or nation from our lives as citizens of God's kingdom. We are citizens of God's kingdom, and that includes our lives as citizens of whatever earthly nation we may live in. I think that's probably where, again, I don't know if it's just American Christianity particular or modern thing, but that's probably where the temptation for, well, although there's plenty of Christians that probably want to idolize the government too. Yeah, there's nothing new under the sun, Pastor Hoppy. Both sides are trouble still today, I think.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking about that kind of as you're saying it too, because there are both, right? There are people that want to kind of just say, you know, government is not a gift of God, right? In fact, you know, that it's this awful thing. But then you're right, there are people, and I don't even want to say on the other side, because I don't want people necessarily thinking here just about the political party. I think there's people in both political parties that want to be dismissive of government, right? And there's others that want to make government kind of the be-all and end-all, even though they would have different ways of speaking about that and different ways of, you know, I guess, legislating that. But yeah, you're right that there is always this sense, at least, in which when we think of government, we want to disconnect that from God, ultimately, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of be free to do whatever we want in that area. And again, this is, it's just this constant reminder that, again, all things are God's, right? And so since all things are God, that's his too. And so we as Christians have to think and pray about and act on what we think is most faithful to God in all of those areas.
Yeah. The second half of the sentence, I think, is the most mind-blowing Again, not that the first part's unimportant, but especially in the context, like, well, look, you know, it's got his picture, so give it to Caesar, fine. But just to this recognition that all things in my life as one who has been created in the image of God then are that which are rendered to God, given to God, and indeed this entire creation then is his to be used, you know, for him, to his glory, according to his word. Like, that's the part that really stands out for us still today. Again, it does have something to say to our life in civil society as a part of politics and all those things, but it goes beyond that, even though it does certainly include that.
Yeah, and I think, don't you think there's always kind of this general idea that the Pharisees always want to draw Jesus into a very specific question, right? And again, at least from my study of, you know, the scriptures about the Pharisees, this seems to be their thing always, is they want to be very precise, right, about the law. And I think, right, then with the idea that then they can justify themselves, right? So that I set this up and I know then I can say I did this. So, you know, a question like this, do we pay the tribute tax or not, is a good thing. If they can get, you know, again, I don't think they're that concerned about it in this conversation, but the Pharisees want to have an answer to that. So then they can say, if it's lawful, I did it, right? And if it's not lawful, I didn't do it. And now I know I've pleased God, right? And again, Jesus always has this way of broadening the whole thing in order that you can see two things, right? That God's ways are much higher than our ways. And secondarily, that we are not able to walk in God's ways perfectly, right? Especially those apart from Christ are not able to do it at all. But even those of us, right, who are in Christ, but yet still struggle with the flesh, right? We understand that we are unable to do this too. And Jesus always has this way. They want to justify, and he broadens it so broad that no one can be justified by works of the law, right? And that, of course, leads to the big question that's always lurking. Well, if we can't be justified by the law, then how?
Yeah. Yeah. You want to answer that one right now, or you want to save that till later?
I can answer it. Jesus. There you go. Jesus is how, right? And again, even, you know, at the end of our, we haven't really, I guess, got to the last verse.
Yeah.
But right, it's poignant where, again, in one sense, this is just a statement of what happened, right? But when you think about it in a broader sense, right? And they left him and went away, right? I mean, like in one sense, they're just saying they left, they went, probably went away to plot again how they could do this. But here's the real issue is that they're not willing, right, to follow Jesus. They're not willing to receive him as the promised Messiah. They're not willing to recognize that he's the Lord of the Sabbath and the one that watches over the temple and all of these kind of things that Jesus will say in the Gospels, right, to show who he is. They're not willing to receive all of that. And so they walk away empty, unfortunately, right? And those of us that, by the grace of God and you know, the faith worked in us by the Spirit who cling to Christ, right? We have everything. And everything we have is God's, right? Put those two together, and then that kind of forms our lives.
Not only do the Pharisees and Herodians leave and go away, but the Matthew tells us that they marveled, which I think is, again, like, well, I marvel at this too, but I marvel at it for a different reason than they do. And I suppose the marveling at Jesus isn't saving faith. You can marvel at Jesus in an unbelieving way, as we see here.
Yeah, and I think this word, even in the Greek, right, allows for either, and maybe sometimes a mix, right? I mean, there did have to be some people that went, how did he get out of this one, right? Yeah. We had it done. How did he get out of this one too? But in the end, right, they're disturbed by it because ultimately they do want to trap him in his words, right? They do want him to be dealt with one way or another. And so they say, we still didn't get him, right? And so there's that kind of marveling too, that he's so wise. And it's, you know, it's sort of, if you've ever been in a debate with somebody that, you know, makes a particularly good argument against your point, there can be that sense where you go, never heard that one before. And that was pretty clever, right? And yet the second later you go, but no, right? That's not it. It still doesn't follow what you're trying to say. And that's, you know, kind of what I see them doing here. It's maybe a little bit of how did we not get him? But, you know, again, if we take the context, they just plotted, they come to Jesus, they go away. I assume at least they go back to plot again.
Yeah.
And again, I think we know from the rest of the story, right?
Right, right. That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, from the rest of the chapter, we see that the Pharisees and Herodians are not the last to attempt to question Jesus in an effort to trap him. And in fact, the Pharisees will at least come back, and at least in the background, a text or two down the road. So this is certainly not the end of the conflict, even though, again, Jesus has dodged their trap and in some ways entrapped them in their own hypocrisy here. Again, we'll see how he continues doing such things during this time of Holy Week. But I do want to come back to what you were saying about the way that Jesus broadens things when they're asking a very typical question of Pharisees, is it lawful? And we hear them ask that question a couple of times in the Gospels. And so they have this very narrow focus. And the way you were describing it earlier made me think of what Jesus will say to them in a couple of chapters where he will talk to them. You guys are really good at tithing things like what mint and dill and cumin, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law. And he says, you should have done the former while keeping the latter. It strikes me that something similar is happening here that, you know, like, hey, your question about paying taxes to Caesar was not out of bounds, but you guys are missing the big picture still, that everything belongs to God. And I think, although we may not, you know, approach it as Pharisees, Lord willing, we don't, that same temptation can still attack us as Christians, that we can focus so much on one little thing that we miss the bigger picture. Maybe talk a little bit more about that here as we got about 4 minutes to wrap things up.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think throughout the scriptures, you do see this, right? It's Jesus also like saying to, you know, that the Pharisees are so concerned about the washing of cups and vessels and all these things. And again, I'm sure if you went to the Pharisees and said, why do you do that? They'd say, in order to be reverent to God, to honor God, right? And yet Jesus has to pull them away and say, no, it's much more important that you stop and actually think about honoring God rather than just getting so focused on the particularities of how we might do that, right? And again, I think that is very helpful for us because each of us does have particularities that we get very focused on, right? And we think this is kind of essential. And again, sometimes those things are essential. I want to make that clear that we do things this way or that way. But there's probably a lot of times where we need to at least have someone say and say, okay, so you're doing this practice in this place or in this setting or in regards to this, whatever, sacrament, this event, whatever. And somebody needs to say, okay, but what overall does God want us to accomplish, right? And again, like you said, it doesn't make the smaller things then not important, right? They did have to decide whether they were going to pay the tax or not, whether that was faithful to God or not. They still had to decide that. But when we get so on the particularities, we can lose the bigger points. And yeah, I think of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, right? He does this where, you know, they loved, it seemed, especially with the Ten Commandments, the plainest sense of the commandment. Again, so they could say, I didn't murder anyone, and I haven't, you know, slept with a woman that wasn't my spouse this week, so I did good. And you know, Jesus says, well, the point about the sixth commandment is not just solely what you've done with your body in the last week, but it's this overall question of purity and sexuality and marriage and children and all this that goes with it. You need to think about that. And again, yeah, I think it's a good thing to bring into the church, especially if you have people arguing over particularities, to have somebody, hopefully sometimes a third party, hopefully sometimes that's the pastor, that can say, okay, let's broaden this. Why are we fighting about this? Is there a good reason to do one thing or another? Or have we just got into this question to see who will take our side?
Yeah. And I think, again, maybe the place to wrap things up is this thought of whose image, whose likeness do I bear? You know, I bear the image of God, not only by because of God's creation of me, but even more because of his redemption. You know, think about the name of God that's written upon us in holy baptism. I think is you know, to apply Jesus' words then to the whole of the Christian life, you are named by Christ in your baptism. So, you know, as we're recording, at least the coming epistle reading from Romans 12, you know, in view of God's mercies, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. That's the whole of the Christian life becomes our response to what our God has done for us.
Yeah. And it gives then witness to who God is, right? And thankfully, again, that's not up to us, you know, by ourselves, right? It's the Holy Spirit living in us, making us new creations, right? Giving us the will to do good, all of those phrases that we find in the New Testament. But in those ways then, right, people are not ultimately drawn to us, the image bearers, but to God himself, to Christ himself. And that's ultimately where we want people to be, so that they finally have this idea too, that just like us, they too need to give all things to God, for, you know, God has given all things to us.
Pastor Philip Hoppe serves at Trinity Lutheran Church in Colby, Kansas. He's been helping us today to study Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 to 22. Pastor Hoppe, thanks for being our guest today.
Glad to be with you.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about this text, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we keep reading Matthew chapter 22 to hear the next group, the Sadducees, come and attempt to take their swing at Jesus that they too will swing and miss. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.
Sharper Iron is a production of KFUO. This program and our station are dependent on listeners like you. To support KFUO Radio, our podcast, and all the other programming, please make your gift or pledge today at kfuo.org/give and help us continue sharing the good news of Christ for you anytime, anywhere. kfuo.org/give.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.